I'm pretty sure Peter, you've seen it on Twitter where I was kind of rewatching the Raptors playoff run last year and kind of giving a little bit of a synopsis of or a game a little game recap of it. So that's what I've been doing, man. Just kind of reliving the dream again, you know.
Man, it sounds like you might be able to relive it for another full year at this rate.
Yeah,
Yo,
I
one
mean,
more year, baby.
Yeah, we're still champs.
still the reigning champs, and Norman Powell still the reigning Eastern Conference Player of the Week. So I'll leave it at
You're like the only person that knows that.
that.
Norman Powell doesn't even know that.
Oh man, funny. Oh, good times. I got to rewatch that whole playoff run again for like the 15th time.
So
Long as you've done this during quarantine.
Literally, I've downloaded every single game in full, including the losses, just to like kind of spice things up. And like, and obviously during the quarantine, right? Like, I've saved quite a ton of money where I've been just like splurging on just like Raptors memorabilia, extra like
Damn.
put like championship shirts, like windbreakers, things like that. Because I'm putting a vault together, like that I could store for like my
Your kids.
generations to come. You know, exactly. Be some
Yo.
classic TBT photos waiting.
He's already planning it like 10 years in advance.
Yeah.
You're assuming that we don't get another one soon.
Huh?
You're
Oh no,
assuming.
we're still the reigning champs, right? So no, but I'm saying the reason why I'm saving all that is because it's the first championship, right? Like I didn't expect them to win that, and the fact that they did, it was like I don't care what happens after. If they win even another three, that one is always going to be special to me. Obviously, Peter, you've seen it on Twitter. Every year, I'm like Raptors insert year, you know, like Raptors 11, Raptors 12, Raptors 13, Raptors 14, and like yeah, and then it finally happened. So good times.
That's when you bring it back that old tweet.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what happened. As soon as the timer went 0-0-0, I already bookmarked all my Raptor struggle tweets, including one of the responses from the Toronto Raptors Twitter account, where I basically tweeted at them. This was, I think, back in 2011, man. Like I had to like watch guys like Roko Ukic and like, you know, Ben Uzo like dropping triple doubles, and I'm like
Yeah, I went to those
Lenis
games too,
Kleiza,
man.
and like,
Those are hard times.
yeah. And I told them, hey, listen, like I'm getting humiliated in my supporting you guys. Like I'm emotional state right now. Like, do you feel me? Yes or no? They responded to me directly saying, hey, there will be better days ahead. Thank you for your support, fam. And I'm like, all right, I bookmarked that tweet. And then as soon as they won the championship, I'm like, hey, thank you. You promised me better days ahead. And there we have it, you know?
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Stretch 4 podcast. My name is Peter Tran, I'm your host, and today online I got my
You
not so
forgot your
much.
name there.
I did, dude. I'm all amped up right now. Not so much pick and pop partner Josh Cohen. How you doing?
My beard is almost as long as the Raptors championship reign right now.
Ooh, double time. I hear you. Iso Raj, how you feeling?
I'm getting excited for this pure Raptors talk. I know Josh is going to have the time of his life.
You're right about that, man. We're bringing on two special guests today. We got Richard Wong and Fada Fada calling in just to talk Raptors, guys. How you guys doing?
What up, what up?
What's
Stoked
going
about the
on?
best team in the world.
Thanks for having me.
Best team in the world, huh?
They're the champions. They
Yeah.
still have Larry.
Well, that is true. Larry OB.
He's still there. He's still there. I don't know if you guys know this, but this is the 100th episode that we have. How about
Oh,
that?
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Centennial
I'm
mark,
very
guys.
honored. And I'm very honored as well to also dedicate this 100th episode to the Toronto Raptors, the 2019 champions of Toronto Raptors. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, pretty much, man. So we're recording this a week early, but by the time this releases, it'll be the anniversary of Kawhi's Game 7 shot. That's why we had to do it on this. The biggest shot in Raptors history, and I had to bring on the two biggest Raptors fans I know.
I
Sorry,
got
Josh,
goose.
here.
I got goosebumps just hearing about that. Game seven. Ooh, all of that. It was amazing, guys.
Absolutely. Can't wait to relive this moment with you guys, so let's kick it off.
I want you guys to like really think about where you were when all this happened, because I want each one of us to go through like, how were you feeling, where you were, who you were surrounded with. Richard, where were you, man? Game seven.
Okay, so yo, I had some friends who had tickets to the game. They had like box seats last minute, told me that like they have a ticket for me. I had my grandmother's birthday to go to that night. And so I was in a, like, I was in a tricky situation. I was like, okay, do I go to my grandma's birthday or do I go watch the game? Game seven.
You'll understand.
So I happen to, we happen to go to the steakhouse, and I get this. I asked the wait staff for the seat with the best view of the TV, so I can watch the majority of the game with like my grandma right in front of me, and I'm watching the game behind her, watching the entire game. Finish fourth quarter. Drive back to my place. I'm literally just streaming this in my room on my own, just losing my absolute shit.
I like that. Putting grandma first.
Yeah.
I can't blame you for that.
What a good boy.
But where were you living this shot?
During the 2019 Raptors run, I dedicated going to the Boston Pizza on Bank Street in Ottawa to watch all the Raptors games. And once we got to the game seven versus Philly, I was kind of contemplating whether to go to the game, and I was looking at tickets, and tickets, it was brutal. Just looking at StubHub and Ticketmaster wasn't happening. So, and I know that, hey, maybe if they had an opportunity to go to Eastern Conference Finals or go to the finals, maybe I can splurge then. But anywho, you might, obviously, you know this guy, Abdi, right? So I was with him, and we decided to go to our friend's house, which we watched the previous Raptors games, playoff games, which we kind of had success. So just being very superstitious, we're like, hey, since we got a couple dubs watching at my boy Niall's house, let's just go there. So we ended up going there, watching the game. And mind you, this is during Ramadan, so I'm fasting, right? So I'm waiting to like break my fast halfway through this game, and I'm already stressing, right? Dude's offering me water. I'm like, hey, I can't have any water right now. I gotta fast for another hour. So, but anyways, as soon as the game started to go, ultimately, I think, what was it? Kawhi missed the shot. Sorry, he missed a free throw. He missed a free throw, and then Jimmy Butler ran in to tie the game 90-90. At this point, I'm like, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse. Am I?
Yeah, feel free.
Okay. I was about to shit my pants, right? So I'm like, oh my God, here we go again. Raptors playoff failures, game seven. Oh no, it's just like, you know, hyperventilating. And as soon as Kawhi gets the ball from the inbound, I noticed that swift travel, but I'm like, oh, I hope to God they don't call it, which they did not, right? And as he's going towards the corner, right, lifts up this prayer. At this point, me and my two boys were standing just like literally in like a bro hug right now, just kind of waiting, like, what is going on? And we see the ball bounce, right? And the way it bounced, it would typically bounce out, but it had this trajectory where it flipped in the opposite side, right? And I'm like, okay, this might have a chance. It's going in. And as soon as the two bounce started to happen, it went in, and we literally roared. I roared like I was like Simba, like after he killed off Scar, you know what I mean? I'm like, let's go. Like, I'm not gonna lie, maybe a couple tears went down, but like, dude, I'm like, this actually happened, like, especially a game seven game winner, first game winner on a game seven in NBA history. So I was glad to be a part of it and glad to witness it. So that was me.
Yo, but who's crying more? Was it you or was it Joel Embiid afterwards?
You know what's funny? I didn't catch the Joel Embiid crying until I got onto social media to kind of catch up on like the hype about the game seven shot. I'm like, no way, did he actually cry? Because apparently like it showed on TV, like just a quick view of it. And if I had to say who cried the most between me and him, I feel like I need to hide that off the podcast. I'm not going to mention it, but no comment. it was definitely an electrifying moment for not only the Raptors fan base, but like all of Canada, just to see them kind of come together, not only for the sport of basketball, but like, you know, for the Raptors and their success beyond. So
was that the game where Marc Gasol had to console Embiid afterwards?
Yeah,
you know it. Yeah,
well,
you
actually
know
before
it.
That he did that classic Christian prayer, right, that he always does, right? As soon as the shot went in, right, he's like, oh, thank God this happened, then went to talk to Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely like just from end to end, that entire game was kind of a tough watch, only because both teams didn't play to their level, right? And the fact that we were able to get on top is typically not expected from any Raptors team, especially considering the history that we had. So all in all, it was a good time.
Yeah, very not Toronto at all.
Yeah, for sure.
Josh, where were you?
I was actually at my house with a bunch of friends over. So I invited a bunch of people over, and ever since game three, I'm very superstitious. So I started wearing a Philadelphia 76ers jersey, hoping that would sort of turn things around.
This guy.
And it sort of did.
Yeah, which jersey?
Iverson.
Was it a shiny one? Like the shiny blue one?
Yeah, it was a nice black one.
Oh.
From back in the day.
Classic.
Oh, one finals, yeah.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, I invited a bunch of people over, and it was sort of like deja vu, because we went to my friend's jazz place. This is like a bunch of years ago, obviously, when Mo Pete hit that shot, the Michael Ruffin play. And after Mo Pete hit that shot, we were all just going fucking crazy. We were like hugging each other, throwing each other across the room. I actually like broke my friend Keith's glasses that day from throwing him to the ground. So Keith was actually there as well during game seven. And after Kawhi hit that shot, we were downstairs in my basement, and the same sort of thing happened where all of us were just like running around, jumping around. And again, I threw Keith, just sort of like the same situation back in the day with Michael Ruffin shot. So that was my experience.
Damn it, you're an aggressive celebrator.
I am.
Jesus.
Note to self, will not celebrate with Josh.
Also, if any eyeglass wear companies want to sponsor this, maybe we can hook Keith up.
Yeah, seriously.
All right, Raj, where were you?
Yeah, so Josh had invited me to his house, and I was debating going or not, but I couldn't imagine being there if the Raptors had lost that game and how disappointing the atmosphere would have been. So
yeah, you bailed on me. I remember that. Yeah.
Well, this guy would basically send out threats like, you better wear the same exact clothing you wore in game four or you're not allowed in the house. So I decided, you know what, I'll probably stay home. I watched the entirety of the game, and it was getting to a point where like it could go either way. But the fact that Philadelphia was sticking around in this game, I'm like, oh my God, should I just watch Game of Thrones? Because I believe it was a Sunday night.
It was.
And yeah, and I was like, oh man. So I get the Game of Thrones stream going. It's like right at the end of the game, and the shot goes on, and I actually had the game on mute, and Game of Thrones was playing the audio, and I'm like, oh my God. And I just immediately turned off the TV, turned on the game, and I watched it live, but I felt like I missed out just because I didn't have the audio going. But holy shit, was that one shot I'll never forget in my life.
Oh, you missed out on the audio, man. Like, that was the best part. Is this the dagger?
Yeah, Kevin Harlan was great.
Oh, yeah. And the Reggie Miller, oh!
Peter, what about you?
I was watching Game of Thrones, man. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, my God.
This guy.
This podcast.
Oh, man. Hey, you guys are the Raptors homers here. This has never, this
yeah,
has
but
never
you're like a
team.
Massive basketball fan. How do you choose Game of Thrones over this?
Dude, it was the last season.
The worst season, according to many people.
Wait, didn't the Nuggets lose in Game 7 to the Portland Trailblazers before that? Is that why you probably gave up on basketball?
Yeah. Harsh, man. That's harsh.
Yes.
Harsh but true. Come on. Harsh but true.
As soon as Game of Thrones turned on, I literally turned my phone to do not disturb. Made sure I didn't get any notifications from you guys, from Twitter, from anything. And then I just replayed it right after. And it was... You know, I kind of regret it. It would have been cool to live it in the moment with everyone else.
Kind of regret it.
I don't regret it that much, man. I'll be honest. But
you know, I gotta say, CJ McCollum was great in that game seven, eh?
Man, fuck CJ McCollum, all right? I'm not gonna lie, though. As soon as Jimmy Butler hit that layup, I was like, whoa, Jimmy Butler, man, this is a clutch-ass play. And, like, I'm sure Josh and Raj remember this. All last year, I was on Jimmy Butler's jock. Like, I was riding that guy, man. He was incredible in Philly. And as soon as he hit that, I was like, yeah, that's it. Philly's got this. They're going to go to overtime. No big deal. And then I saw that shot, and I was like, holy shit. Kawhi is a different animal now.
You know what's funny, though? I've listened to Jimmy Butler's comments based off of the series against Toronto, and he mentioned that, like, hey, if it went to overtime, Philly would have taken it. And I was like, okay, this guy's just being a poor sport, until I heard Ibaka's comments, and he was saying, thank God, like, it was ended by the end of the fourth quarter, because they had no gas in overtime, which supports Jimmy's claims saying that like Philly could have taken it. So I definitely understand where you're coming from when Jimmy Butler hit that layup, right? It's like that uh-oh moment for the Raptors.
Yeah, and this is a series where only almost all the games where it was with like Kawhi, he would just take over, and he had an insane shooting series against a really great defense and a massive starting lineup. And in this game, nobody besides him and Serge really stepped up in this game. So if they went to an overtime, I'm not sure how much Kawhi really had left, because none of the other guys were really showing up besides those two.
Right. But can we give a shout out to Nick Nurse and the fact that he was able to identify an adjustment that helped the Raptors, where he started off big with Siakam at the 3, Ibaka at the 4, and Gasol at the 5? Because I feel like that just drastically changed things, like defensively and offensively for that matter.
Yeah, that was in the third quarter, right?
Yeah, I think he made that change in game 4, I believe, because obviously the Raptors were just playing way too small, and then obviously when you look at their bench and how they were very inconsistent or basically non-existent, to be frank, with Van Fleet and Norm, right? They needed to play big, right? So obviously Ibaka being on the bench, they decided to start him with Siakam at the 3, and
they didn't start him in this game though.
No, not in this game, but like for adjustments to be made, like mid-game adjustments rather. So that was a key thing that Nick Nurse was able to bring up.
Yeah, on that note, when Philadelphia wanted that run in the third quarter when they were up, I think, 8 points, I think that's when the adjustment happened for that game anyway, where they went bigger for at least 4 or 5 minutes and it worked. But after the win on that run, I was, you know, as Fat has said before, shitting my pants because I thought it was over at that point.
Yeah.
You really get that shook, eh? Is that just like a...
Oh, yeah. I mean, in that type of game where you're up like 8 points, it feels like you're up 20 because, you know, the pace was so slow. And any type of lead just felt like it was a lot more than a regular game where you're scoring 100-plus points. And this game is just a slog.
Yeah. Unless I forget the Raptors' like previous history in these type of games, too. That also doesn't help your case, obviously, with your confidence, right? Even when the Raptors are up like 10 or 12 points in a game 7, you're kind of like, okay, well, let's hold on now. Let's wait until the time is actually 0-0-0. Like, you know, I hear you, Josh. Like, I mean, when they were down 8, there was a little bit of a scare there. And obviously with Jimmy Butler scoring to tie it up 90-90, you're kind of like, uh-oh, but glad that Kawhi was able to save us once again in this series and hit the game winning shot and then off to Milwaukee.
I just keep replaying this in my head. It's like, what if he made that free throw? Like, what if he did all that stuff? Would it be as epic? Like, obviously it'd be epic because like we still qualified, but like, would it have been as epic?
I still think the Raptors fans in general will take whatever they can get. So even if it's not going to be as epic as, for example, the shot that we're talking about, I still feel like it's still going to be respected and cherished amongst Raptors fans and just fans across Canada and the world. So. The one thing I do want to say, though, with Jimmy Butler's two, obviously I like to dissect these games to like a granular level for some reason. Obviously I have all the time in the world, but when Jimmy Butler was running up for the layup to tie at 90-90, I noticed that Jimmy Redick was open on the corner 3, and I was worried that he was going to kick it out because Siakam was able to catch up to him. Or catch up to Jimmy Butler, but Jimmy Butler was able to make the tough layup. So I was curious, like, man, if he was able to kick it off to JJ Redick for the 3 and then they'll be up 1 with like 5 seconds left, like, mind you, we don't know if Kawhi would still be able to hit the shot or not. Like, as a Raptors fan, those are the kinds of things I think about. It's like, oh my God, what would happen if we're always thinking the worst? We're never thinking the best, right? So that kind of adds to our kind of paranoia as a fan base.
Yeah, sorry. Just to answer your question as well, I think the fact that they hit that shot gave them a bit of confidence going into the next series with Milwaukee, because it was almost like it was destiny for the Raptors to make it through, despite how inconsistent they were in that series and how little production they got from the bench. Even when the odds didn't look in their favor, and Jimmy Butler even said it, that they were probably going to win that game if it did go to overtime, they like managed to squeak by, and it kind of gives you a little sense of invincibility when a player like Kawhi hits the biggest shot in franchise history. And it was probably the first time the Raptors had a clutch moment like that we can remember with a big amount of significance.
Totally agree with you there. One of my questions was just like, do we think that the Toronto sports fandom still feels that way? Or do we think that we've now broken that curse and in clutch moments that we think we can actually persevere? Or do we think because we lost Kawhi that it's all the same as old times?
I think we're all feeling pretty good right now that Masai decided to stay, so far anyway. I mean, his extension's coming up, obviously, which, you know, they should just give him all the money trucks available in the Toronto area. So, I mean, when that happens, I think we've become the San Antonio Spurs of the 2000s now. That's my opinion. Okay, I think chill. No matter who
relax.
We bring in,
relax.
That player is going to succeed. I mean, look at what they've done with the bench so far with all these G League guys. Even a guy like Chris Boucher has become, you know, a rotation player on a really good team. Norman Powell has become one of the better players off the bench, and he can be a starter on a lot of teams. Just the development in our coaching and then also the executive team, I have a lot of faith now in this organization to actually make the right decisions, which is something I would have never said 10 years ago.
You didn't trust Rob, like Rob Babcock back in the day or Brian Colangelo?
The one thing I am thankful over with Rob Babcock and, you know, that terrible management team was the tickets were so inexpensive. I got to go to like 5 to 10 games every year. So that was a plus for me. I got to see like the start of Chris Bosh. I got to see Yao Ming, one of his, you know, first appearances in Toronto. I got to see LeBron in his rookie year scoring 56 points against the Raptors. So I've been to a lot of fun games where the Raptors lost most of them, but they were still really fun to be at.
Okay, as Toronto faithful fan, all of you, I'm pretty sure, have just been born into this culture of Toronto sports, or at least Toronto basketball. What was like the bleakest point in Raptors history for you?
For me, it was probably when Vince said he didn't want to dunk anymore. And like, just knowing that like, the thing that I want to see was like his dunks, and this is like our superhero just giving up on us, and I'm just like, okay, well, this is unfortunate.
Wow, I did not expect that answer. That's pretty good.
I mean, for me, it was probably the Kevin O'Neal years, because in those years we had Michael Curry starting a small forward. And in a lot of games, we were scoring like 70 points. It was like the worst basketball I ever watched. And back then, I was like watching every single game, no matter what. And I had a really hard time getting through those games, I got to tell you.
What years were those?
Like 2003? I'm not even sure, man. Time is different now. I'm not sure.
That was post-Vince, right?
Yeah.
No, I think Vince was still on the team at that time.
I think the turmoil situation.
Oh, okay. That year. Just before Aaron and Eric Williams joined the team?
Don't even remind me. And Alonzo Mourning deciding not to go to Toronto after all. So
I remember where I was when that trade happened, too. I was actually in an Orlando hotel room on a vacation with my family, and I saw that come across the Sports Center ticker, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I'm like, we traded Vince for what? I was shocked.
Yeah.
What about Bargnani years, guys?
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. Like, with the bleak years as a Raptors fan, I would say the back-to-back draft of Rafael Arujo in 2005 and then 2006 with Andrea Bargnani. Like, you know, when we could have got guys like Iguodala and LaMarcus Aldridge or like Brandon Roy or like other guys that can be paired up with Chris Bosh to continue on. So that was definitely a moment where I'm like, where is this organization going? Because I mean, with Bosh, you know, he was kind of emerging as one of the young stars of the league, right? Especially in the power forward position, and he wasn't getting any of the help. And obviously, looking at Vince, right, I can tell right off the bat, like, he wasn't getting any talent or continuous talent to work with, right? And ultimately, that led to some of his frustrations beforehand. But I was kind of hoping, hey, with Chris Bosh in mind, like, let's make sure that we can surround them with some talent that we can work with, especially young talent from the draft, and bring international guys like Rafael Arujo and Andrea Bargnani, which I haven't heard of him until like literally the week before the draft occurred, right? It was just brutal. Although they did make the playoffs in 2007-08, but those first round exits mean nothing to me. But yeah, those were the bleak years for sure.
I still want to say, like, even the, like, every time LeBronto or one of those other things where we know that we had a good team, but it's good, but not like we were, I always felt like we're in an issue where we're too good to get good draft picks and lottery picks, but we were right. So bad that we couldn't go anywhere. And we're just stuck in this, like, in this constant state of like a paralysis in between there.
Yeah, I mean, like, with the whole LeBronto thing, man, like, it was super, super frustrating, especially 2018, because 2018 was no excuse. Like, LeBron was carrying a bunch of scrubs, and, like, when you're looking at the Raptors team at that particular moment in time, like, they were the favorites, right? They were the favorites to win in that series. And mind you, when you look at the fact that the Cavaliers barely got past the Indiana Pacers in 7 games, goes to show that the Raptors clearly had a chance. And looking at that game one against the Cavs, right, we were leading for most of the game until like the tail end of it where the Cavs were able to steal it. Once I stole game one, I vowed to myself to not watch a game for the rest of the series. I didn't watch game two when LeBronto truly happened. I didn't watch game three when the buzzer beater happened. And then game four was a wash with like DeMar DeRozan kind of fouling out as like his, or I guess being tossed. I think it was like flagrant.
He got benched.
He got benched. I thought he got tossed for flagrant fouling. What's his name? Jordan Clarkson or something. I don't know. But
was that the year that Jonas missed all the tips?
Yeah, that was game one.
Yeah, that was game one.
Yeah. And then the LeBron running, like the full court runner, I guess, if you want.
Full court floater off the backboard, like it's practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to say something about that. So after that shot happened, I went onto a Toronto Raptors message board. And there was
Which one?
What's that?
Which message board did you go on to?
It was actually called like Toronto Raptors Forum.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So a bunch of people on there, including like a moderator, were arguing that we should have fouled LeBron while we're in the penalty so he could shoot his free throw so we can get the ball back because we already know that he's going to score at the buzzer. And I'm looking at this logic like, what the fuck are you talking about? Even though he hit an insane shot, like just from basketball theory, you're never going to foul a player and give them the 2 points to put them ahead just so you can get the ball back. And I was arguing with this guy for like hours and I'm like, what am I doing with my life?
You officially became Toronto Raptors internet man.
That's it. I mean, that game was like painful enough to watch, but I think game one is probably the most painful game that I watch as a Raptors fan, just, you know, from the fact that we thought we were actually going to win that series, like Fata said, and then losing that way, you know, being up the entire game and then Jonas missing those chippies, even though he got fouled on two of them, but we're not going to go into that.
Doesn't matter. you gotta hit the bucket, man. Doesn't matter.
True.
You know what's funny? One of the most, like, not one of the most frustrating is, but I say, like, up there from last year's run was that game one against Orlando. I'm like, here we go again. Yes. These game one failures. And then the Lowry 0 points. Oh. And even, like, Damon Jones, right? Like, obviously, before the game, he said Orlando was going to win the series. I'm like, this guy's a loon, right? And then Lowry gives him this ammo, right, by not scoring not even 1 point, and we lost by a point. You know, like, that's just a frustrating thing that, like, we have to deal with as Raptors fans. But, like, I knew Lowry was going to bounce back, but I just didn't want him to give specifically American sports media that kind of ammo to, like, keep shutting us down, right? So, yeah, definitely game one Orlando was definitely a funny thing to watch, for sure. Especially DJ Augustine dropping, what, 25 on an efficient, like, 9 for 15 or something like that. And mind you, Vucevic was nowhere to be seen that whole series, too. So we really got beat by DJ Augustine alone. What do you think about it?
I also don't want to like detract this whole conversation, but I just also love the most Canadian new chirp that I found is calling someone a loon.
Yeah. Amen.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I can't even call him a loony because a loony is worth one and he couldn't even score 1 point to begin with. So
We will not tolerate the type of Lowry slander in this podcast. Come on now.
Yo, Josh, relax, man.
I do that for jokes. But, like, obviously, it's just fun to kind of joke around with that as a Raptors fan. But, obviously, like, there's definitely that deep appreciation for Kyle Lowry and what he's done for the city and for the franchise, right? So, it's just, like, I just hate the fact that he gives the media something to talk about. I think that's what it comes down to, you know?
You're fat of backpedaling real hard.
Huh? Yeah, I don't think Lowry's
saying it seriously. Like, I'm just being serious. It's just like, yeah, obviously, as an NBA player, and as for someone of Kyle Lowry's caliber, it's unacceptable to not score no points. And obviously, losing the way that we did, obviously, is concerning at that particular moment in time. But, you know, you got to call a spade. You know, like the guy, he did what he did for our franchise. You know, coming in 2013, giving his all, being the heart of the system. You got to respect that, right? So.
Yeah, but I hear a lot of people giving Lowry a lot of love, and I think deservedly so. But at the same time, if Kawhi doesn't hit that shot last year and they obviously don't win the championship, isn't he kind of on par with DeMar DeRozan? Like, what did he do that's so different than what DeMar did? Because DeMar didn't succeed in the playoffs. He was very efficient or somewhat efficient in the regular season. and then he just couldn't perform in the playoffs. Kyle Lowry kind of has that same story until last year, and it was really Kawhi that helped the Raptors kind of get over that hump.
Yeah, I mean, like, he does more. So Lowry at the very get-go does way more than DeMar DeRozan. DeMar DeRozan is a good offensive player, you know. He can score somewhat at will in the mid-range game, right? But at the same time, we have to hide him defensively. He's not a great defensive player. Playmaking is questionable, right? But when you look at Lowry, right, and what he can bring on the defensive side of things, and, you know, with the charges and with the playmaking, getting other guys involved, mind you, his scoring may not be as, might be as high as others, right, or DeMar DeRozan, rather, but he does a lot more for as a team than what DeMar DeRozan brings to the table.
Yeah, Lowry sort of got like that Jason Kidd effect, where if he doesn't score a lot of points, he's still affecting the games in so many different ways, where that's like, you know, screening off the ball, the little things, you know, and taking charges, obviously. So his value is ultimately a lot more. He brings a lot more to the game than DeMar DeRozan does, especially in the playoffs, where those little things matter because the game's slowed to a halt. And you need, you know, single things in a possession to work in order for your team to succeed. And he brings those things even on nights where he's not shooting well. So game six against Golden State, for him to start out as he did and basically be the hero of that game besides Van Vliet, obviously, brought a tear to my eye.
Oh, for sure. But let me put this out there. That game five against the Warriors, if Lowry hit that shot, if it wasn't blocked by Draymond Green, oh my goodness. Imagine having two clutchest moments. One of the two most clutchest moments in NBA history, or NBA playoff history, rather, where we have one to make it to the Eastern Conference Finals and one to actually win the championship at home, would, I think, cement Lowry's legacy, not only as a Raptor, but solidify his position in the eyes of NBA fans as, you know, a capable point guard that, you know, will show up in the moment. You know what I mean?
I assume he's like always relives that moment, just wishing that he ended up actually making that shot.
Yeah. And I was there in game five. I was like not in the arena, but I drove down to Toronto to watch the game. Like at my boy's crib. And I remember leaving early for work. I literally left work at like 2 p.m. I'm like, I cannot miss this game, this potential finals winning game. And as soon as, like, obviously Draymond blocked the shot and the Golden State Warriors won game five, I go out on the streets of downtown Toronto and everyone's just dejected. Like, it's just like, ugh, like, we're giving them another chance to go back to Oracle. Mind you, this would be the last Oracle game. It's our last game at Oracle, right?
Yeah.
Because they're moving to that new arena. And I'm kind of glad that Lowry was able to shut down the critics by, you know, coming out hot out of the gate. You know, I think he scored what, like 15 points in the first quarter alone. So, yeah, that was a pretty good moment.
Okay, before last year, what were your guys' thoughts of Kyle Lowry in the playoffs specifically? Because Kyle Lowry during the regular season, we all know, has been a consistent all-star for the past like 5 years, right? But during the playoffs, like Raj, you said it earlier, we always saw Kyle Lowry like sort of shrivel up as the 1A, 1B option with DeMar. You know what I mean? But now that we have a clear number one in Kawhi, and then Lowry at this point was like a 2A, 2B with Pascal. So, I don't know. I think what I'm trying to say is, did he finally get his spot like at that echelon? Because he's not a number one option. So that's for sure.
I think it goes to show, I think what Lowry was able to determine during this playoff run, and even like comparing it back to last year, was that he might be better off being a number two, number three option. And that's okay, because he's a number one option on everything else. You know, when it comes to being the leader of the team, you know, getting people involved, taking those charges, you know, those kind of momentum swing plays, right? It just shows us that we don't necessarily need to rely on Kyle Lowry scoring as a number one option anymore. And I obviously I don't mind it, right? I feel like at this point the Raptors blueprint should be finding a star that could cherish that role and then have Kyle Lowry, you know, kind of complement that. You know what I mean? So after last year and the way they flamed out of the playoffs in 2018, I thought that, you know, listen, just blow the whole thing up. Like, I think it's not happening. Like, just trade Lowry, trade DeMar.
No.
And that I was on that side. I was on that side before the Kawhi trade, right? I was like, I've had enough of these two. Let's just build the whole thing from scratch, right? We already have Siakam, we have OG. Let's just start building young and just build a new culture, because this culture of 5 years of Lowry and DeMar, and don't forget, Lowry and DeMar weren't Masai's players. They were inherited from the Colangelo era. So Masai obviously had enough, right? And that's why, you know, when guys like Kawhi Leonard or someone of his caliber becomes available, you gotta shoot your shot, right? So that's why he was able to just kind of get rid of DeMar so quickly. But once Kawhi got onto the team, I'm like, hey, listen, this is the one last hurrah. I kind of had a feeling Kawhi was not going to stay anyway, but like there could be a chance he does. And again, my heart was broken on July 6, 2019. At like 1:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, you know, when the Paul George trade happened and then Kawhi, I'm like, oh man, you can't be that guy. The first guy in NBA history to be a finals MVP and leave his team right after that. So I'm kind of glad that one year rodeo happened. Now that, you know, we're able to see guys like Siakam and OG and Norm grow, that could potentially extend the golden years of Raptors. So.
Yo, have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? When I was trying to get this podcast off the ground, I had a lot of questions. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show onto all the apps that people like to listen to? How do you make money? The answer was pretty simple for me. I started using Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. And best of all, it's 100% free and super easy to use. And now, Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise in your podcast. So that means you can get paid immediately, like right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading you this ad. Super simple. So if you always wanted to start a podcast, let's start now. Go to anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of producers using Anchor. Again, that's anchor.fm/start. See you soon. Was everyone on board when Masai made the decision to trade DeMar for Kawhi Leonard, even if it was just for like the 1 year loan?
Oh my God, yes. I was so happy when that trade went down. Because I was sort of like Fada, where I really wanted the team to blow up in some way. And the way I wanted it to be done was for Dwayne Casey to be gone, obviously. Like, I hated Casey throughout the entire run. And honestly, I was never a fan of DeMar either. So both those guys going and then bringing in Kawhi Leonard, who was one of my favorite players to watch. I mean, it was, you know, win-win for me.
So Peter knows this, but I was joking. I was going to make a Masai snake emojied jerseys just because I was a super loyalist, man. I loved Lowry. I loved DeRozan. They were the heart of the team, and so I was heartbroken about the whole thing itself. But I guess hindsight's 20/20, right? I'm really happy that happened now.
How quickly did you turn around on the trade?
5 games in?
No, it really wasn't. I think it started probably about halfway through the season when I knew that I wasn't always watching all of the games, but I knew that because I had all the notifications on my phone that even though the Raptors would be down like at the third quarter, that I just know that the fourth quarter, the Raptors are going to take it. And then they eventually started doing that. And then I started realizing, I was like, okay, like this is a different type of team. They might actually have a shot and I can actually get my hopes up again.
So you actually had like confidence in this team.
Yeah. Yeah. But it took me about halfway through.
Okay. I was going to say, on my side, like when the trade happened, I went to war with a lot of Raptors fans on social media, because again, there was, you know, the loyal aspect of it. It's like, hey, how are you going to trade the guy that literally wore Toronto on his sleeve, you know, and the fact that LeBron is out of the East, like, let's just give it one more try with DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry and with Nick Nurse as a coach. Maybe things could open up, you know what I mean? But when you're talking about a guy of Kawhi Leonard's stature, like, you have to go for it. Like, obviously, we don't have players that are going to come in and or star players that would come in and sign, right? Typically, that's like kind of the aura of like the Toronto franchise is not being able to retain stars. But when you bring a guy of his caliber, you got to go for it. So I was a Kawhi supporter from day one. I knew this trade was going to help the Raptors, but I didn't know to an extent where we would win a championship.
Yeah, but I just want to jump in as well. I think the issue with Kawhi coming to the Raptors is like he didn't play at all the year before with San Antonio. So like that's where I think a lot of Raptors fans felt a little hesitancy and like, what kind of Kawhi are you going to get? Are you going to get him for 10 games or like 50 games or a season? And also, it seemed like a one-year rental, which it ended up being. But DeMar was a player that a lot of Raptors fans saw grow up in terms of his development. Plus, he brought a lot of early success, success the Raptors never had had. Like, we were the top team in the conference for 2 or 3 years in a row, and we had big expectations. Obviously, we failed them in the playoffs. But I think the fact that you're getting a bit of an unknown with Kawhi at the time and getting rid of one of the players that was loyal, who embraced Toronto, who went through a bit of the tough times early on his career and then actually had some success later down the stretch. And it seemed like he kept reaching that one obstacle, which was LeBron, obviously. And LeBron's a pretty big obstacle for most players. Like, he's arguably the best player in the world. He went to 8 straight finals. So, like, losing to him is, I don't think there's any shame in that. So, I know Kawhi's a better player. I think Toronto obviously won that trade now, but even at the time, they had a potential for being better, but their floor was also lower.
Like, yeah. Guys, remember this. Like, DeRozan, I just looked this up. Like, DeRozan at that year was like the 14th most sold jersey in the NBA, just after Draymond Green, but sold more jerseys than Anthony Davis. Like, he was the heart of our city. He's a superstar that actually chose to stay here. So it just felt really betraying and really sad.
Yeah, just to get to Rajon's point about the unknown of Kawhi, I felt like for him to play, you know, the 9 games in the previous year and coming to the Toronto Raptors, I believe from a business standpoint, he had no choice but to play. So that's why I had a little bit of confidence knowing that, like, you know, he has to give it his all, knowing that his free agency is pending for next year. And in order for other teams to have the confidence to give him the money that he's looking for and the term he's looking for to produce, right? So that's why I was very confident in that. And also with the whole DeMar thing, the fact that just the Raptors in general couldn't pull off even one win in the last 2 series against the Cavaliers, especially the one in 2018, was just a big no-no for me, I guess, considering that, you know, the Indiana Pacers was able to push them to 7 games, and also the baby Celtics with rookie Jason Tatum was able to push them to 7 games to the fourth quarter, literally. And but as a number one in the Eastern Conference during the regular season, we can't even win one game. Like, that was kind of like the big no for me.
Yeah. And was it last year or the year before that that Masai was trying to trade Kyle Lowry to the Knicks? Was that a few years ago? 17?
Yeah, that was 2014.
14.
2014. Oh. He tried to trade Lowry to the Knicks, I think, during the trade deadline, but then that fell off, and then they lucked out with this golden era. So it was good times.
I like that. All right. I want to move into the play. Like, I guess we've been talking about the playoffs the whole time, but what were your expectations for this team? Because I remember distinctly saying that if we wanted, I said we as if I'm a Raptors fan. I'm just clearly milking it right now.
Mm-hmm.
If the Raptors wanted to keep Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green, can't forget almost Finals MVP in 2013, Danny Green. If they wanted to keep these two guys, we would have to see them make at least the finals, right? Like, there was no other expectation for Toronto to be able to keep these guys. But I don't know, going into the playoffs, I don't think any of us saw them making it all the way there. Did you?
I did.
Really?
I picked them before the year started after the trade happened. I mean, I was obviously being optimistic, but going into the playoffs, I was very confident that they were the best team, best starting lineup, which, you know, means a lot going into the playoffs because you're only going to play about 7 guys, right? And, you know, our 2 guys off the bench were Van Vliet and Ibaka, which is very good. And then you have Norman Powell, obviously, as well. So going into the playoffs, I was pretty confident. I thought if we could beat Philadelphia in the second round, which was going to be the matchup going into it based on the seeding, I thought that they were the biggest obstacle because I thought they had a starting lineup that could really give ours a lot of problems, which they did. But, you know, Kawhi obviously went like Michael Jordan mode throughout most of that series. His averages were absolutely insane going into Game 7. And then beyond that point, even when we were down 2-0 to Milwaukee, I was still pretty confident that if we win Game 3, which that game was one of the hardest games to watch of the entire playoffs, obviously going into, I think, double overtime. But I thought if we won that game, we'd be able to, you know, to get momentum back. And I had trust in Coach Nurse by that point that he was going to be able to make the proper, basic rotations and, you know, adjustments to facing Milwaukee, and he did by putting Kawhi on Giannis. And that just goes back to, you know, starting off at the beginning with DJ Augustine in game one. He had Kyle Lowry guarding him, which wasn't working. So what he did was put, you know, guys like Siakam and then Kawhi at certain parts of the game on Augustine, and Augustine couldn't even get a shot off. So I think at that point, a lot of our Raptors fans started to trust Nick Nurse and seeing, like, he sees what needs to be done, and he's actually doing it instead of just staying in a mold that a lot of coaches get into where they only play their system and their style. So, you know, I think in the offseason, it was between him and Budenholzer for the Raptors job, and Budenholzer is a guy that just sticks to his system. So honestly, I think if we had Bud instead of Coach Nurse, we probably wouldn't have won last year.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're taking shots at Dwayne Casey right now, but also Coach Bud.
I always take shots at Dwayne Casey. He was a terrible coach, especially in the playoffs.
Peter, to answer your question, I straight up, like, I love the Raptors. Such a diehard fan. I did not think we were going to go very far. You and I spent, like, so much money on tickets because we kept on thinking this was going to be the last game that we end up playing. I spent the Princess Ransom on all of the stuff, but very happy that it all ended up that way. But, yeah, I will be the first to say I love my guys, but I didn't have a lot of faith.
I think Peter knows my answer.
it's been consistent for like 28 years, I think. Yeah,
drop the mic.
I think once we got Marc Gasol, though, like that was the trade that really hurt me the most because I loved Jonas Valanciunas. But once we got Gasol, we were just so versatile on defense, and Gasol could really move his feet a lot better than JV could, especially coming out in the pick and rolls, being able to trap, which you wouldn't expect from a guy that big. But once we got him, like just his knowledge of the game and just how smart he was on both sides of the ball, but especially defensively and being able to cover up for any type of mistakes, which this team didn't make very often. Like we were one of the best defensive teams in the history of playoff basketball last year. And a big part of that was Marc Gasol.
Yeah, with the Marc Gasol acquisition, I think the one game where I truly appreciated Marc Gasol was, I think, his second game as a Raptor when he was at home against the Brooklyn Nets. And he was making some absurd passes. It was kind of like taking Kyle Lowry and like making him into like a 7-footer, like in terms of like just seeing the floor and like, you know, finding the open man and just throwing passes through the needle. At that point, I realized like, you know, we have something special here. You know, obviously kudos to JV and like, you know, his offensive talent. I really enjoyed his offensive talent, but when you look at him defensively, especially with the pick and roll defense, like it was something where opponents was able to pinpoint and kill us every single time on. So with Marc Gasol, again, like you mentioned, Josh, the versatility was key. And again, it helped us out throughout the entire playoff run and ultimately a championship.
Speaking of Marc Gasol, I think one of his biggest contributions was in that Philadelphia series. And I think Josh has mentioned it a few times, like when we were talking about this earlier, Fata, like you'd mentioned it, like going into that Philadelphia series, like as a fan, what was the biggest worry? Because the Raptors on paper, like that was probably going to be one of their toughest matchups of the entire playoffs.
Two words, Jimmy Buckets. That guy is a certified Raptors killer. Like, I remember watching even like when he used to play for the Bulls, he used to come into the Raptors arena and just completely destroy every hope of the Raptors winning that game. And the fact that I think this was like, yeah, this was the first time we played against him in the playoffs. I was kind of shook at that. Joel Embiid, I wasn't too scared of only because I knew that Marc Gasol, being the defensive talent he is, was at least able to somewhat slow him down. But it's just, with Jimmy Butler, obviously, he would be matched up against Kawhi, but he's I don't know, somehow he's always seems to find his way in the fourth quarter, especially against the Raptors. So that was the one guy I kind of feared a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest thing with the 76ers must have been the size, right?
Yeah, like Ben Simmons is their point guard. We have Kyle Lowry. That's insane. And like, not to mention, like Joel Embiid is a massive dude. If we didn't have the Big Spain, we wouldn't have been able to take him.
Were you going to call him Big Poppy?
I was going to call him Big Poppy. Getting my other references mixed up, guys.
Also, another certified Raptors killer, Mike Scott. This dude was, oh my God.
Not the one from the game, office.
No, not from the office. Yeah, I need to clarify that. But every time he's inserted into the game, somehow he's like a momentum shifter. Hits a couple threes with his little like ninja Nike headband, you know, and just like talking that talk. Like he just always used to kill us. So that was also another thing too. James Ennis also had a low-key okay series too. He shut down VanVleet completely off the grid.
Hold on, because you mentioned Mike Scott, this is bringing like a whirlwind to my head right now. How many random-ass players in the league are certified Raptors killers?
There's a lot out there.
Like, there are always these most random players that just torch. Jeremy Lamb had 2 game winners against the Raptors last year.
Jeremy Lamb has to be
out there. Definitely a killer. Paul George, of course.
Yeah, Gerald Henderson. That guy was a problem. That guy was Michael Jordan when it came to playing against the Raptors.
The other one back in the day was Eddie House. Eddie House used to always kill us.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, Eddie House, that's a good pull.
We definitely need to do an episode on Raptors killers. Like we can go all day with this.
The leader is LeBronto.
I was gonna say Kobe, dude. 81.
Yeah. Oh, Kobe was an automatic bucket, man. Like even to the point where like he was kind of like falling out of his prime. I think this was back in like I want to say 2012 or 2013 when he had guys like Allen Anderson guarding him and like Terrence, a baby Terrence Ross. And I remember there was a point where the Raptors were up like 10 in the fourth, and then Kobe just took over and won that game. And I was like, oh, this guy can never like stop. I don't know. He just keeps going and going and going and going. So
you're talking about that game at the Staples Center, right?
Staples Center, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. When Aaron Gray double teamed him for nose in that half court. that's a like, classic Raptors moment.
Tried to trap him at the top of the key. Like, what are you doing?
Man, he used him as a screen against his own player.
With the crowd roaring. Right handed dribble. Gray comes out to double. Kobe around him. Kobe down the middle. Dunks it home! Kobe Bryant! Aaron Gray came out way too early and way too high. I said Kobe would be able to walk around him. He just waltzed around Aaron Gray.
That's a great Kobe moment. All right. Since, Josh, you seem to love talking about how deep this Toronto bench is, can we just look at these guys quickly before we, you know, before I give that much praise to them? Because Norm Powell was pretty much unknown until, what, the Milwaukee series? Like, he didn't really have a real effect in this series. Fred VanVleet was, I don't even know where Fred VanVleet was during this Philly series, but dude was not in the building. How are you giving that much praise to this Toronto bench when, you know, obviously in the playoffs it goes shallow, but two of your main guards weren't really showing up for the games.
Now, it's worth talking about, like, before the playoffs started, if you look at the benches throughout, you know, the playoff teams that were coming into play, I think that Toronto had three, like, in terms of their top three guys coming off the bench, that's a pretty good top three, right? If you got Ibaka, VanVleet, and Norman Powell. And they played well throughout the season, too, right?
No, VanVleet last year didn't play that well.
He was good. He was not as good as he was this year, obviously, but he was still solid.
VanVleet averaged 10, like 11 points last year off the bench.
Off the bench.
Yeah, off the bench. That's pretty good.
That's decent, yeah.
Come on, man. Seriously?
And he was reliable. Like, when he's on the court, he's not a defensive liability either because he's a pretty thick boy, right? So.
Uh-huh. And then how did you feel about him not showing up for all of this Philly series? Or Orlando, for that matter. And half of Milwaukee. I mean, we all know the story that Fred VanVleet just ethered the whole NBA as soon as his baby was born after game 2 of the Milwaukee series. But before that, like, he was pretty unknown in the playoffs.
Honestly, looking back at the Philadelphia series, if Philadelphia just made one key adjustment and just tried to go a little bit smaller and not play, you know, Boban Marjanovic and Greg Monroe behind Joel Embiid and just played Ben Simmons at center, I think we probably would have lost that series. Because in those minutes that Embiid didn't play, I think they were like minus 96 over the course of a series that went 7 games, which makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, Greg Monroe was awful. If you like, I watched the Raptors playoff run on Sportsnet and TSN when they were showing it last month, and when he came on, I think his field goal percentage was probably around like 20%, and he was missing like wide open layups. And then you're just like, wow, like Masai had the ultimate move by cutting Greg Monroe. Philly picks him up, and then he ends up benefiting the Raptors.
The other one was Marjanovic, because whenever he came on the court, the Raptors were always like plus 10, plus 15 in a matter of 5 to 7 minutes. Because the Raptors had a clear guy they could just go after every single possession. Whereas when, you know, Philadelphia played, you know, James Ennis instead, and they had Embiid on the court, you really had no one specific target you can go through, and their size was just like too much for us.
Yeah, I think Josh hit the nail on that one with the whole size thing. With the Philly series, especially, you know, when you have big guards like James Ennis and Mike Scott, like, it's going to be difficult for, you know, guys like Van Fleet at least to contribute in a sense. So I kind of like written him off for the Philly series. The Milwaukee series was kind of iffy only because, you know, they still had big guards. I mean, they had like Eric Bledsoe, God bless his soul, man. I love his shot selection because it helped the Raptors. Dude, I'm like, what are you doing shooting threes? Like, oh my Lord. But so yeah, like, you know, guys like, you know, Bledsoe and, you know, even like Middleton to a certain degree. Like, I thought that, you know, it was also going to be a write-off for Van Fleet. But, you know, again, after the whole baby was born, he was able to go off. And, you know, I was thinking like maybe like he was kind of worried that like his baby was going to be born with some complications or something, so maybe that's why like his mind wasn't right or something. Because literally right after that, I think like the baby was born in Rockford, Illinois, which is like 40 minute drive from Milwaukee. So he went there and then met the Raptors for game 5, and that's when he dropped the 7 threes, like 7 for 9 from 3-point arc, and then was hot ever since. So God bless Van Vliet Jr.
Yeah, but let's go back to Van Vliet, because there was moments where I think I've said things about him that I've never said about a player before, because he had some atrocious performances. Like, I know Josh and Fatah and even Richard, you probably know that Van Vliet was like almost unplayable at some points in that series. And I will ask you guys, and how many points do you think he had total in that series?
Oh, jeez.
I want to say, like, 13.
Are we playing Price is Right rules apply?
Any rules.
Anyway. $1, Raj. $1.
Right rules apply? Like, I might go $1, Bob.
Right, give it to us, Raj.
It's 14 points in the entire series.
Wow.
And in the games, he went... First game, he was 1-for-2 from the, like, from the field. The next game, 0 for 2. The game after, 0 for 7, 0 for 2, 2 for 5, 0 for 1, 0 for 5.
But here's where I like kind of give him a little bit of credit is, like, if I'm playing my player in NBA 2K, guys, and like I'm playing a Fred Van Fleet build who's like super tiny, playing against a length team like that, yeah, they're shutting me down completely. So like he was at, for that particular series, his odds were stacked against him because he just couldn't do much. He was just being well defended.
Okay, what do you say about Norm though? Because Norm is pretty big for a guard. He's 6'4", and he didn't have his fair share of contributions for that series.
Yeah, can we read off Norm Powell's stats too, Raj?
Yes, please.
give me a second. It's probably gonna be non-existent.
This one from a Raptors Praise podcast to just ripping on bench players podcast here.
Can you also read Jeremy Lin's box score too?
Yo.
Did not play. A lot of DNP CDs, I'll tell you that much.
Indeed.
But the Wikipedia page says one-time world champion.
That's all that matters.
If you really want me quickly to go in Powell got around 21 points, but he played a lot less minutes than Van Vliet. And I know we mentioned how Nick Nurse made an adjustment in that series by playing Ibaka a bit and playing big. But I think at some points in that series, and I think on the whole, I think Brett Brown actually outcoached Nick Nurse in that series, even though they didn't win.
Really? How so?
I disagree.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this either.
I don't know. I think if you look at that series, the way that, like, if you watch it, and I know Fatah has, that Brett Brown was very smart with not letting the Raptors get a lot of momentum. And if you look at just the production he got from his bench, and of course Joel Embiid has a few games where he was not good, and there's some debate he wasn't feeling well, he was in Marc Gasol's pocket, this and that. But Nick Nurse stuck with his guns and it ended up playing off in the long run. But had they lost that series, I think a lot of people would have been questioning his reluctance to stay with Van Vleet. And Van Vleet averaged like 16, 17 minutes a game, maybe even more. And his contribution was nil. Whereas in Brett Brown got a lot of production from Mike Scott, James Ennis. Embiid obviously wasn't feeling good one game. There's an argument to be made that he did a pretty good job and they brought them within one basket to making the Eastern Conference Finals.
I don't think you can still say that he outcoached him just because of the minutes without Embiid. Like, he just never figured that out in a 7-game span. So I think for that, I think you really have to, you know, look at that specifically and say we were minus 95 or whatever it was without Embiid on the court in 7 games. And I couldn't figure out a solution to give him 3 minutes of rest every half. Because, you know, even though Embiid wasn't really performing in the offensive end, all the Raptors fans were like scared of him because he was so freaking good defensively. And he was the reason why the Raptors just couldn't score any points in the paint besides Kawhi getting in there for his little short jumpers.
The Raptors also had their fair share of injuries as well that Nick Nurse would probably have to coach around. Like, remember, like, Lowry had his wrist issue. Kawhi was still injured. Fred lost a tooth. Like, guys, there's a ton of injuries going around all around. So I would say, like, all the coaches really had to coach around some of those different issues. And I think ultimately it's about who gets the win.
Hey, I want to bring something up that you actually kind of triggered in me. Basically, when you're looking at like potential players to play off the bench, could you even imagine how valuable OG Anunoby would have been in that Philly series?
Oh,
like he's a big body, you know, 6'9", like, you know, 230. Like, I mean, like when you're talking about adjustments, like, he's the guy that probably Nick Nurse really, really missed a lot, you know, in that series and had to sacrifice by, you know, either going big with Ibaka or sticking with his guns, like you mentioned, and kind of just taking the L, right? Taking whatever result you get. But I feel like he would have been a crucial piece in making things easier for the Raptors when it comes to playing against the 76ers.
OG could have slowed down Raptor killer Mike Scott.
But don't you feel like also at the same time, like Brett Brown, he just really underutilizes his talent. Like, I mean, like with the whole Ben Simmons thing, I feel like he could do much more with Ben Simmons. And I feel like,
I think that's a Ben Simmons problem. I don't think that's a Coach Brown problem.
Like, as a coach, you should be able to put your player in a position where, you know, to get him to, you know, shoot, invest confidence in him. Like, it still shocks me that he just doesn't take a shot. You know what I mean? Like, outside of the mid-range, you know, like mid-range, he doesn't.
Not even the mid-range.
But if your player is a stubborn asshole, then, you know, what can you do? Because look at all the years that we hated DeMar DeRozan for not shooting threes. I'm sure Dwayne Casey wasn't telling him to only take mid-range free, like mid-range jumpers. But if the guy just is unwilling to do it, he's unwilling to do it. You can't really force that part as a coach, can you?
No, I feel like, Dwayne Casey is classically known for not making adjustments. So I don't know if he was the type of guy to be like, hey, listen, DeMar, you really have to start shooting these threes. And again, I feel like also DeMar probably was stubborn, like you mentioned, where, you know, he kind of want to stick with what's comfortable with him and what's within his craft, which is the mid-range game. But he understands the game's evolving. And, you know, if he doesn't evolve with what the game is today, you know, look at him with the Spurs. Like, I'm sure Popovich is having a hard time trying to figure things out with him, right? So I feel like, yeah, you're right when it comes to DeMar DeRozan, but I feel like the coach should have some say or have some pull when it comes to making sure a player could utilize his talents to the best of their ability.
I hear you. I don't know. From what I've heard is that Ben Simmons has been practicing his three-pointers so much now that he could probably hit mid to late or mid to high percentages in the 30s instead of shooting low 20s.
And the funny thing is, too, from last year, when you look at last offseason, you're seeing like Ben Simmons like hitting threes in these like open runs, and you're like, okay, well, this is going to be a different year, and he only just shoots one. And I think he made that one early in the season, and he never shot again. So I'm not falling for these workout videos anymore. Like, Ben Simmons is the last straw for me.
But just speaking about Ben Simmons, like, if especially as a professional, like, clearly teams are playing off of him and giving him that shot, and he's still reluctant to take it. And I'm pretty sure Brett Brown's come across a few times this season where he's tried to encourage Ben Simmons to shoot more. So I'm kind of more with Peter on this point. Like, I think the opportunity is there. It's not like a scheme that Brett Brown is going to draw up and get Ben Simmons open. Like, the shots are there. He's just not taking them.
I think in this series, though, when looking back at it, he was often the fourth or fifth option on offense behind a lot of these guys, even like J.J. Redick running around screens. So I'm still a believer in Ben Simmons in that if you put him in a system where he's like one of the main guys, if not the main guy, or he's being used as like a pick and roll big man where he gets to make the decision off the roll, I think he can still be like a top 10 player in the NBA in the upcoming years.
Hey, hey, hey. Do not knock someone running around using screens to get an open look, all right? There's nothing wrong with that.
I'm not knocking JJ, I'm knocking you, but yeah.
You really think Ben Simmons can be a top 10 player?
Oh, absolutely. He's got a lot of talent.
Without a jump shot?
Like, yeah, for sure.
Current Ben Simmons.
What's that?
Current Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons right now is like a tall Rondo from 09.
I just imagine him in a system where he has four shooters around him, and he doesn't have one big guy just taking up all the space in the paint where he can just, you know, be the guy who runs the pick and roll, or even as a roll man, and you have to make a decision as to what you're going to do with him instead of having like two other defenders standing in the paint waiting for him. So mm-hmm. I think if you put him in a position like what Giannis is in Milwaukee, where he's like the only guy going to the rim and you just have a bunch of really good shooters around him, he could be like a real weapon.
But like as a basketball player, like don't you think, like, for example, Ben Simmons, he's pretty much elite at everything other than shooting, right? Like, doesn't that motivate him as like a player to be like, okay, the only gap in my game is shooting. Let me just get it to at least the average. And then he will know for sure that he will be like a top 10 player easily if he just had an average jump shot or a respectable jump shot. You know what I mean? But like, I feel like if I'm playing and someone's giving me like 6 to 8 feet of space in front of me, I take that as disrespect. I got to work on my game at that point. You know what I mean? Especially a guy of his caliber where he's an elite defender, elite playmaker, you know what I mean? Solid size for a point guard. And all you need is just an average jump shot. Like, I don't understand the reluctancy of like not being able to perfect your craft or at least get it to an adequate level where you can have a respectable shot. Like, that's just beyond me as like, you know, as a guy that plays basketball.
Yo, Fata, you take like half a foot of distance as disrespect, all right?
Yeah, for sure. Bro, I'm pulling. Bro, you have that clip of me pulling up from nearly half at the sports park. So it's like, you know, at least just shoot it. It's just like, yeah, again, it's a confidence thing. And especially like if you're trying to be the best player in the league, you got to have confidence. Like, you play basketball your whole life, you got to shoot. You know, you got to work on your craft. I don't know. I just have a major beef when it comes to that. Like, yeah, Ben Simmons can be like the best that he could be if he just had an adequate jump shot.
Not even an adequate, but like I've said this about DeMar for years, you don't need to be like a league average shooter to be a threat, right?
But right, if respectable jump shot.
Yeah, like for if DeMar had a 3-point shot, even like low 30 percentages, but if he took 2 or 3 a game, it would actually spread the floor a lot more, right? Defenders would have to second guess every time you're out there rather than just being like, oh, I'm good. I got like 4 more feet before he's willing to do anything with it.
Oh, I just said you just need enough to be a threat. That's all you need.
Yeah.
I don't know. In the playoffs, though, like smarter teams are not going to care. They're just going to leave him open anyway, right? Like the regular season, you get away with that and you can shoot 30 to 33%. But in the playoffs, you're not going to have guys move a couple feet off of him just because he shot 30% in the regular season. It's a different game.
But ball players, I don't think most ball players think of it as, oh, this guy shot X percent. Like, I got to worry about it. It's more of, yo, DeMar can hit a shot. Yeah, DeMar's a good shooter. I got to D up on this. It's not, like, I think at this point it's beyond the analytics and the execution on the floor. It's the mentality of the defender where it's like, oh, shit. I know DeMar can shoot. I gotta get a little tighter on this.
With how DeMar's career went, though, he should have taken the Dwayne Wade route and just become a great cutter. Because if he did that, he would have added at least a couple points more to his game. He'd be a lot more effective off the ball. Whereas, you know, now in the past years, all he did was stand around the perimeter.
Yeah, yeah, okay, we're not saying DeMar is like... I don't want to use DeMar as the example. He's just an easy example to use as someone who could have added a shot to his repertoire and been much more of a threat.
Yeah, but it still goes to show, like, certain players are able to, you know, figure out the other intricacies of the game, going back to, you know, Kyle Lowry and doing certain things off the ball and even on defense, and DeMar just never figured it out.
Peter, I think you're essentially insinuating, like, a Draymond Green type, right, on the three. Like, Draymond Green's not a three-point threat, but he still takes a couple of them a game, and he's averaging a 3-point shot. So he's like enough to be a little bit of a threat, but definitely not enough to swing a game, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, they're not Russell Westbrook out there shooting, you know what I mean? Like, no one's that bad. I'm sure Ben Simmons can shoot better than Russell Westbrook can.
Like we can also talk about even the evolution of Siakam's three-point shot. I mean, like, when he first came into the league, like, he was kind of like a, you know, a high-energy rebounder, slasher kind of type of player, right? And no one knew that he had the capability of creating a shot for himself, you know what I mean? So the fact that even from last year, I think he was shooting, like, 32%, and now he's like up to like 36%. You know what I mean? Like, so he's able to add that to his game where, like, now teams are kind of catching on, saying, hey, let's keep an eye on this guy if he's on the 3-point line, you know, just at least to have like a light contest, right? So when it comes to guys like Ben Simmons, like, that's where my respect level goes down a little bit. It's like, hey, if guys like Siakam and a few others can develop their shot or have the heart to do so, what makes you not being able to do that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree. He has much more to offer than what he's done already.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You guys got any final thoughts on the Philly or Orlando series before we knock this off here?
Who are you guys going to take? Pascal Siakam or Jason Tatum?
Oh, I saw that B-ball breakdown video of that, surprisingly, like a couple days ago. Their stats are very they're eerie alike for some reason. Like, obviously, when you look at both players, like, Jason Tatum is 4 years younger, you know, has a lot more upside. A lot of people argue that Siakam, what we're seeing from Siakam is probably closest to his ceiling. But I counter argue by saying that he's only been playing basketball for, what, 7 years? So yeah. He's a late bloomer. So I feel like sky could potentially be the limit for him. So it's hard to say. Obviously, it's favorable to say Jason Tatum only because he's young, 4 years younger. So yeah, I guess the debate will be on the table. Hopefully Celtics and Raptors can play in a playoff series. I've been dying for that. But getting back to the question for final thoughts on the Magic and 76ers series, I kind of wish the Magic was a sweep. Like, that game one, like, still somewhat bothers me, but at the end of the day, we got it done, right? We finished in 5 games. I think that was the quickest series that we've finished in franchise history, with best of 7, of course. And then as for the Sixer series, by far, in my opinion, the most entertaining series, because there was so much unknown, right? Because the 76ers being such a strong, big team, you know, championship contending team, we just didn't know what to expect. And, you know, the fact that the Kawhi shot happened kind of put the cherry on top. So those were a good two series to watch.
My thoughts, I think it was true art.
And two, OG. I don't dress, man.
But you saw me in my scarf.
OG, I don't dress, OG. I do art, bro.
I wouldn't have changed it any other way. It was like our full-on, like, trials and hardships, and it was magic. And I will always watch the entire series happily over and over. It was amazing.
Yeah. I was gonna say, Richard and Fada, man, thanks to both of you for joining us on this. This is great to recap. It's nice to relive this kind of stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We'll have to bring you guys back once we do the actual like full playoff recap, because
can't wait.
Also, one thing I'd like to add too, which I was able to kind of speak to the rest of my friends and colleagues about, this particular question: who would you take in a 7-game series? And I'm pretty sure you've seen this on my social media. Would you take the 2019 Raptors with Kawhi Leonard, obviously, or take the 2016 Cavs? And I was kind of hoping that maybe in the future we can maybe talk about it in much greater detail.
Yeah, we'll each do research for this. That's a really good question. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe. We're on iTunes. You got us on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Anchor, all the major podcast platforms. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Stretch4Pod. And until next time, peace.